Hello and welcome to Open Minds Radio. I am your host Alejandro Rojas and I am joined by Jason Draco McClellan. Hey there, buddy.
Well, hey there to you, my friend.
So I said that Draco or Draco because that's like supposedly where the reptilians come from, and you have the creepiest Facebook picture, you and Maureen, because again, you've been getting accused of being reptilian, and you got that picture really creeps me out.
Well, it creeps me too. Creeps me out too. But you know, when you've been outed, you've been outed.
Did you make that picture, or did
a
listener?
Yes, that was the accuser.
Oh, the accuser made it. And so people know, you know, he just took a screenshot of Maureen and Jason. He made them green with like these lizard tongues coming out of their mouths, and they look silly, but the accuser seems very serious, that he really thinks that you guys are evil reptilians.
That's because he's correct.
And he also did something about Open Mind still being controlled by the Illuminati or something.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We are the problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, oh well. What can we do? Let's see, what's the script?
Good fun.
What's our Illuminati script say we're supposed to cover next here? Let's see.
I know, right?
Well, I guess, but that's why I called you Mr. Draco, but...
I appreciate that, thank
yeah.
you.
But we can't spend too much time screwing around here, Jason. I know you like to be silly and stuff, but we got to get to business, because this is our first show of the year. We haven't done a show because we've been so dang busy. I mean, with the conference.
It's so exciting how soon that's coming up.
Oh, a month from today will be the second day of the conference.
Yeah, wow. That's scary but awesome.
Yeah, scary but awesome. That's a good way to put it. I agree. So crazy. So the UFO Congress, of course, is coming up. We'll talk some more about that, but so super excited about that. It's going to be so much fun. I mean, I every time I look over the speaker list, I personally think it's really exciting and a lot of great stuff to share. I think it's really cool. So I'm very, very excited for that. And we have so many friends from all over coming that it's difficult because we're so busy that often we don't have as much time to spend with all of these people as we would like to, but it's going to be really awesome.
That is the most unfortunate part of the whole thing.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many people there and you'd like to see them all, but
yep.
It's also such a busy time that you don't get around to seeing everybody.
Yeah. So before we get into the news, because we want to cover a few of the items that have been going on at the beginning of the month, and it's actually been a busy month now that I look at it, but I want to tell you about our guest today. He's going to be Bill McDonald, and this is really exciting because some of you know that there is a Roswell spacecraft tester model. Some of you have probably built it. I myself built it. Really cool. And of course, it looks like kind of a delta shape. It has, Bill always talks about it being similar to like a stingray or dolphin kind of shaped type of stuff. There's rumors that it had something to do with the development of the, stealth bomber and stuff like this, all of which is going to be in a book forthcoming by Bill McDonald, because he was friends with John Andrews, an artist who helped him get this model created. And this is all, you know, John Andrews was friends with the guys who developed those technologies. So it's going to be in his book. We touch on it a little bit, but we talk about some other stuff. Bill McDonald has been in law enforcement for many years. He was a private detective. and an artist. So he did a lot of forensic artwork. So we talk about how he's kind of coupled his detective work and his law enforcement experience and forensic investigation techniques to UFOs. And so that's what we're mostly discussing. And his ideas about what he's discovered are things such as the motivations of abductions, why they happen, and stuff like this. So interesting stuff. So we'll be talking to Bill momentarily. However, first, Jason and I will be talking about the UFO stories of the year 2015, which has only been a couple weeks. So, Jason, do you want to start?
I will certainly start. And you are right, Alejandro. I mean, we're a little more than halfway through January, and it has been a busy January, a busy year already. I want to start off talking about a recent story, one from last week, about a new UFO movie coming out. Now, this is a science fiction adventure. It's not a documentary or anything, but it's a movie called Legends from the Sky. And this is a film that is being created by an Arizona filmmaker. And it involves a UFO crash, a secret government agency. And the cool thing about this is it's a Native American story, an American Indian cast. Not completely, but most of the cast is American Indian, and that's something that the filmmaker is passionate about. That's what he tries to do, go to the reservations and work with people who want to be in his movies. And he's worked with several of the same people over the years with his various films, but this movie looks pretty great, I've got to say, about a UFO crash and a crash retrieval and a secret government organization. And the thing that, you know, that's covered in a lot of movies, but something that I find fascinating is the American Indian cast, because as we all know, there are lots of American Indian legends that involve extraterrestrial star people. So I can't wait to see how that plays into this movie. And the filmmaker seems like a really cool guy, and he will most likely be entering this movie into the film festival, the EBE Film Festival at the International UFO Congress.
Yeah, that's been confirmed, I understand. So it will be at the Congress, which is really exciting. Due to your story, you know, they were real excited, so they got a hold of us. And they've also invited us to go to see a screening of their, a VIP screening of their movie. Unfortunately, you're not in the area, so I guess unless you fly in, you won't be able to make it. I know Maureen is, and hopefully I'll be able to make it too. But really excited about it. The other thing with American Indians and movies, they're often played by non-American Indians, so that's kind of cool too that they have a lot of actors.
Yeah, and something else that's entirely authentic with this movie is the filmmaker tried to incorporate a lot of native languages. So there's like a lot of dialogue in here that's like actual Navajo. Cool. It's going to be really cool to see.
Yeah, I'm really excited to meet the filmmakers and to see it. It looks really cool.
Agreed.
The first, I guess, story I'll talk about is I did a story, and I just would like to hear your thoughts. I won't go over it too much. I talked along Coast to Coast and some others about it. But, you know, as usual, I did the top UFO hotspots for 2014. I took the MUFON numbers, and I crunched those numbers to see where the UFOs have been reported. As usual, as we've gone over every year, you know, they're usually reported more UFO sightings in the states that have more people. However, what I like to do is match that up per population to see how many, what states have the most sightings per person. That really, I think, is more accurate as to where the hot spots are. Southwest is always up there. States like Nevada, Arizona, Colorado, and of course New Mexico. Those are all in the top 10 as usual. But you may find this interesting, Jason. At number one was Oregon. How weird is that? And it was like heads above per population.
It is interesting to see that is number one for 2014, because we didn't really hear a lot about Oregon sightings that year. In previous years, there were, you know, waves of sightings off the coast of Oregon. So that would have made more sense to me. But last year with Oregon, that is surprising.
And I went and looked at the data per month to see if it was a wave that caused this, but not really. There were a couple months that were a little higher than the rest, but not super, you know, not a lot higher. So it doesn't seem to be a wave, but a consistent high level of reports in Oregon this year. And of course, we have heard anecdotally from people telling us, which is kind of interesting because I don't see this so much. You do see it, but it seems like more so in Oregon when we post a story about UFOs in Oregon. It does, although I don't think we did that at all at 2014. There were no UFO stories really for 2014 in Oregon. But people saying, oh yeah, we see them up here all the time.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. And I've done this before, but I will again compliment you and thank you for your approach to these hotspot lists, because I agree with you. I think it is important to look at it, you know, based on the population and per person.
Yeah.
It gives you a more accurate reading.
Yeah, totally. You know, there's another news organization that did this just this week. I can't remember who it was, but they did a similar story, but they did it by population. So sure enough, you have all the biggest states up there, California, Texas, Florida. So it's not really a fair representation of, you know, what's getting more reports per person. So yeah, I wanted to talk about that. Do you have any more stories? I have a couple other I want to touch on.
All right. Well, this might be one that you want to touch on because, surprise, surprise, and by surprise, surprise, I mean not at all, already here at the beginning of 2015, we have yet another scientific study talking about proof of life on Mars. So Curiosity, through some photos taken by the Curiosity rover, a geobiologist in Virginia studied these images, and based on her 20 years of experience studying microbial structures on Earth, she's pretty convinced that what is seen in photos in the Martian dirt or in rock is sedimentary structures of microbial life. And, you know, this isn't somebody who – and again, not everybody on the Curiosity team is an expert in all things biology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are other people who have made this their living. So she's done this specific study of terrestrial structures for 20 years. So mm-hmm. she says, I'm pretty sure I know what to look for, and I know what I'm looking at in these pictures. So again, microbial life, but she says it's pretty clear to her. She says she's open to other opinions from scientists, and she wants other scientists to take her research and peer review it. But she says based on what she's seen in her 20-year career, she's pretty sure that these are fossilized structures of microscopic organisms on Mars.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what's great about this isn't like the, you know, we get these stories all the time, and we got another one today. I get this from some guy, you know, seeing all this stuff on Mars. He thinks there's statues and stuff, and I just don't see it. I'm sorry. It looks like rocks. It looks like you're looking at clouds and seeing bunny rabbits and stuff. I don't see it. But this is an expert, and she is a well-respected expert that is being taken very seriously.
And unlike some of the previous studies talking about evidence collected from meteorites here on Earth and, you know, problems and complaints about the quality of publication this research has been published in, This particular research was published in the journal Astrobiology, and mm-hmm. you know, when it comes to astrobiology and the search for life, Astrobiology is a pretty serious journal.
Yeah.
So it's cool to see that more of this is coming out, and as we mentioned at the end of the year, and as we always mention, Alejandro, that evidence just keeps mounting.
Yeah, I wasn't gonna actually go there because there's just so much. I think people are getting flooded with it, but the thing is that it's still coming more and more. And I mean, even today, there's another story about the microbes. It's just, yeah, already in 2015, we have new discoveries supporting this idea that there's life. It's amazing just how it keeps coming and coming and coming. So it's so exciting.
It is. All right. So you said you had a couple more?
Yeah, a couple more. Okay, right. Of course, I think we've got to mention you wrote the story on the petition, the seventh sign time. Steve Bassett has done a We the People petition. He got a response to one already. So to be honest, And I know people love this stuff and they want to keep doing it, and I support you all. Go for it. But I don't know what he thinks he's going to get, even if he gets 100,000 signatures. He already got a response to a similar petition, so I don't know why he's doing this again. I don't know that it's going to have an effect, and I don't know that anybody at the White House knows anything about UFOs, and that's who he's petitioning to say something or to have hearings. So, and of course, the White House does not have that much influence over the Congress, especially in the last few weeks. So, you know, this is geared towards having the White House pressure the Congress to have hearings. But unfortunately, the White House is pressuring the Congress on a great deal of many things and having no luck in any of them.
Yeah, I mean, again, I mean, and even with the very first one we talked about, having issues with the wording and just the approach here with these things being very accusatory. And, you know, just the phrasing of these petitions and what the petitions are actually seeking might not be the best way to go about it. You know, playing it from the other side, thinking about the White House when somebody comes at you and says, "You tell us right now, you're lying, you son of a bitch." It's, you know, you really think that you're going to get the response you want? Probably not.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, seventh time around asking for all of these different things, I think it needs to be a more focused effort. And, you know, there are a lot of people out there, like you said, who are firmly behind this, think this is earth-shattering, going to change the world. But we've been down this road before, and, you know, there's not really anything here indicating that anything's going to be any different this time. So.
Yeah. And you know, those are our personal opinions, having been around the block for a while and having seen this for years. You know, I think especially people who are new to this whole field, they love to see some action going on. And but I got to say, people keep saying, you guys need to be promoting this. And we are. We are, you know, telling people about it. We're more than happy to tell people about it. We're excited to tell people about it. We're excited for people to go participate. Please do. I personally say, you know, I'm good job to Steve Bassett for continuing to do something. And I think a lot of people respect that he's out there actively doing something where a lot of people aren't. So I agree. I respect him for that. That's wonderful. I want to say great job, you know, and everything, despite my hesitations or I guess skepticism. But yeah, great for him. I hope that, you know, I'm happy to promote it, and I hope that everybody who wants to goes and sign it, even though I don't know what effect it'll have if he does get 100,000. So far, it looks like he's got 9,000. He's about at the halfway point here, so he needs another 90,000 in the next couple of weeks. Maybe if there's a big story on it, you know, CNN or somebody picks it up. If they do pick it up, they'll probably make fun of it. But hey, sometimes any media is good media. So if maybe there is some big hubbub about it, making fun of it or otherwise, that it'll help him get his 100,000. But he'll probably just get a response saying, "Well, we already answered your question. Nothing's changed," I would imagine.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point, pointing out that the already existing response, and even Steve has pointed out himself that, you know, some of the petitions that have met the threshold of 100,000 signatures or have been waiting for a response for a very long time. And because he's, like you said, he's already received a response basically about the same thing, they would probably just say, "See previous response below."
Yeah, yeah. So we'll see what happens. But we could talk more about this. You know, you guys can go out there and read the story on it. Another thing, just because it went viral, I want to talk about. And this is really funny how this happens, and I'm sure you agree, Jason. We never know what's going to go viral. So, you know, I talk with John Greenwald a lot. He's great from the Black Vault. I really love his work. And we see the eye to eye on a lot of stuff, so we're always talking back and forth. He was able to get these Blue Book files, and people say he stole them. No, he didn't. There's this gentleman who was able to get all of these files, and he came to many of us and said, "Could you guys get these online?" But he wanted to remain anonymous. You know, Jason, we talked about this because he went to MUFON, and we did do the web work for MUFON, and we were like, we don't have the time, even for us. You know, we don't have the time to get these online. I mean, it's very, very difficult work. Well, John Greenwald was able to figure out to create this program that automated the process. Plus, he hosted it. This is gigs and gigs of files. So he was able to host it, which can be expensive, which is... So he figured it out. It's great work. And so finally, John Greenwald has these up there. They're free. They're easily accessible. There has been another way you can get them for free, but you have to download an image at a time of a page. Very painstaking and difficult. Many of us researchers, such as myself and Jason, have been using these different methods, and it's been very difficult. So now it's easy, so the future researchers can get these files really simply at the Black Vault. So I threw something up quickly, hastily and quickly, because I was busy with other stuff, but I wanted John Greenwald to get as much exposure and credit for his great work as possible. And the media picked it up big time. The Daily Mail wrote about our story and linked to us, which is great. And then everybody started writing about the Daily Mail story on this. And it's gotten all over the place, kind of crazy. So it was on Yahoo, and I just read it on Air Force Times this morning.
Media outlets, yeah, even this morning, are still posting it like crazy.
Yeah. So mostly what they're reporting is inaccurate, of course, but... I even admit, you know, I could have written a longer story to clarify the whole process and how it worked, but I just wanted to get some quotes up there from Greenwald and stuff. But, yeah, that's gone all over the place. So kind of funny.
It is really surprising. Yeah. Like you said, you never know which one's going to be picked up, and, people have just eaten up that story.
Yeah. You never know. And then just a couple other stories. One of them that has gone somewhat viral for us in the last couple of days, which is good because it's really interesting. I want to talk about that more. But there were thousands of people in Argentina who reported UFOs over a couple towns there. We saw this first. I saw it first on UFO Chronicles. So I looked more into it and found there were a lot of people who posted videos on social networking. Really, all you see is these little dots in the sky. You can't make much out from the videos. Who knows what it was, but it's interesting that thousands of people reported it and thought it was something more mysterious. But I think even more mysterious, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this one, Jason, is these UFOs over these nuclear plants in France and Belgium. So ever since October, and especially in the months of October and November, there were a lot of UFOs seen over these nuclear plants in France. They thought they were drones, but the authorities don't know where they come from. So even if there are drones, they don't know who's doing it. They think it might be some activists that are flying drones over, but there were some kids who were caught in a parking lot who were about to fly a little toy drone over them, but they feel they were copycat, the situation, so they got in trouble. But they don't know, and how weird is that? So it's continued to go on. Just recent as last couple weeks, this has happened. It's happened in Belgium, and groups like Greenpeace are saying, hey, guys, you better get this under control, because if these are drones, then these nuclear power plants are not secure against drones if you've got these unknown vehicles flying over these nuclear power plants. And of course, some of the local UFO researchers have talked to civilian witnesses of these drones and said, well, what some of these civilians are describing are, first of all, multiple craft, but they don't feel what they're describing fits drones. They think it's something more mysterious. So even if they are quadcopter drones, how crazy is that after months they can't figure out where they're coming from?
Yeah, and really absolutely concerning that it's such a sensitive area. There are confirmed reports of these unknown things in the area. So drones or something more mysterious, it's disconcerting. Mm-hmm. But the multiple reports and multiple witness testimonies are fascinating. So, it's... weird that they can't figure it out, and that makes it all the more interesting.
Yeah, and it looks like this story hasn't really made it to the U.S. I found some U.K. papers writing about it. Of course, it's all over the French papers and Belgium papers and German papers. So Europe is really abuzz because France says they are on high alert because of this situation. So... it's like a big deal in Europe, but hasn't gotten over here yet. So just Yeah, it is really scary, especially given the terrorist attacks that have happened or have been squashed by Belgium and French law enforcement recently. So it's very concerning. It's pretty crazy stuff, I think.
It is, and it is interesting that it hasn't made more headlines, because this is a pretty big story.
Yeah, it really is, if drones or otherwise. And I do want to say thank you to Andreas Mueller, who runs a German kind of UFO paranormal website. And he wrote a story, and he stays in contact with us. Sometimes he writes stories for our website. But he wrote a story with some of the witness testimony and images that he allowed us to use. So thank you to Andreas. And you can get more on the website. So you can find all of that at openminds.tv. There are some of the highlights for the month. It's been a busy month, really, hasn't it?
Yes, and it's not over yet.
Yeah, no kidding. So it's only halfway over, my gosh.
Yep.
All right. So I guess, did you have anything else you wanted to mention news-wise, my friend?
I don't think so. I think that is all.
All right. Well, you get back to sitting on your reptilian eggs to hatch them, or whatever it is you reptilians do. You probably
hatch eggs and hatch plans.
Yeah. Oh, do you go out in the sun and kind of do that little push-up thing that reptilian, you know, lizards do?
Yep, try to get closer to the sun.
Yeah, cool. Well, you have fun. I have nothing against reptilians. I love the little lizards out here in Arizona. They are cute and they are wonderful. So all the more power to you. I, for one, welcome our new reptilian overlords.
Overlords is such a ridiculous term. Can't we just coexist?
Yeah, I agree. Let's just all get along. Well, thanks, Jason. It's wonderful to have a reptilian friend to get along with. But let's talk with Bill McDonald. I am very happy to welcome Bill McDonald to the show. Hello.
How are you today?
I am doing great, and it's been very exciting to get to know you in the last few weeks, and great to have you on the show, because you're responsible for that Roswell tester model, which I built.
I appreciate that, but I also want to give credit to John Andrews,
right,
now deceased.
Right, right.
He did all of the draft table work, along with a gentleman who rendered the AutoCAD images for what eventually became the tooling for the model kit. What I did was bring the project to testers, along with 22 detailed drawings that clearly conveyed that the Roswell spacecraft was a seamless and utterly smooth combination of high-altitude wave rider and low-altitude ground effect aircraft all in one.
Mm-hmm. So, and one of the things you've done, just so people know, I mean, is that you work in law enforcement, so you have brought those skills to UFO research, and that's you applied these skills to produce that image, correct?
That's absolutely true. In the mid-80s to late 90s, off and on, I was a consultant paid by a detective agency to volunteer my time as a forensic sketch artist to the Los Angeles Police Department. That was back in the days when Chief Darrell F. Gates was still chief. It was back before the Rodney King debacle. And the last time I worked with the LAPD was in 1998, when everybody nationwide was involved in the Gianni Versace manhunt for the murderer of Gianni Versace in Florida. And I was on Channel 7 Eyewitness News every morning for 3 mornings straight, drawing pictures of what the suspect looked like.
Wow.
In various disguises, because he could even dress woman. He was very androgynous. And after that, he was shot dead only a few blocks away from the Versace house on a boat at one of the marinas. And the fun and games was over. Mm-hmm. After that, they disbanded South Bureau Homicide, and I went back to being an old-fashioned gumshoe private eye. And at that time, I was already married and working with my wife on her website. And, you know, all the artwork and everything that we were doing in the 90s and the early 2000s connected to alienufoart.com, which is my wife's website that she built from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
It includes pages that she made on me and my artwork, as well as all her paranormal investigations and all of the fun that she has throughout the last 2.5 decades
mm-hmm.
with her paranormal research.
So you worked with on that craft Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt, correct?
Well, Kevin Randall and Don Schmidt had witness. They had access to witnesses that at the time nobody else had access to.
Mm-hmm.
And that was from 1993 through 1997. And they gave me access to those witnesses, and we formed a partnership.
Mm-hmm.
And Don Schmidt was also an artist. He is also a sketch artist. And he had copied very, very detailed images freehand from one particular witness, Frank Kaufman, and there were other primary witnesses, including a few that were found by me that were outside of the scope of Randall and Schmidt, that made it possible for me to build and utilize the techniques that detectives use, where you have multiple witnesses
mm-hmm.
all describing the same vehicle, the same object, or the same person, in order to build what then becomes a generalized composite.
Mm-hmm.
A composite is defined as a rendered image that takes all of the descriptions that match while subtracting individual parts of the description that don't match, until you have a fully realized image, a fully realized description that everybody's happy with. And the more witnesses you have, obviously, the more accurate your composite.
Mm-hmm.
And that became the general composite of the Roswell spacecraft. But the Roswell spacecraft isn't the only vehicle that I've ever worked that particular set of techniques with. And it's certainly not the only flight crew. My whole thing, since the model kits came out back in the late 90s, and there were two of them, there was a crash site kit to go with the pristine version, which is the one you built. The crash site kit was in resin. Testers released both. They were both extremely popular. Sales were through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And from a commercial standpoint, it was a very successful business venture, and everybody enjoyed a little taste of the rewards that came with it. The thing that I want to stress in, you know, my current interviews, because I need to step away from the Roswell case at this point, because I'm in the middle of a book
mm-hmm.
on how we did the general composite of the Roswell UFO, how we accomplished it, which witnesses were involved, and also who were some of the major players in the military-industrial complex that verified my research. But that's all going to come out in the book.
So
we're going to step away from Roswell and, you know, talk about various types of UFOs in general and various types of flight crews in general, because the techniques are always the same,
mm-hmm.
but the flight crews are not always the same, and neither are the vehicles.
Mm-hmm. So your relationship with John Andrews is, and how that all happened, is that also going to be in the book?
His relationship to Ben Rich, my relationship to him, everybody's relationship to Clarence L. Kelly Johnson, who brought John Andrews and Ben Rich in to his inner sanctums, and how he took both men under his wing, one who was a direct employee at Skunk Works, the other of whom was a young graphic designer working for the old Comet models going all the way back to 1963. Cool. Both men were very, very young. They were in their very early 20s. And Kelly Johnson had a very strong relationship to both of them. But that'll all be in the book.
Okay, cool. So, and just so people know, I mean, what's interesting about the craft, and we'll talk about some of the others, is, you know, you talk about the stingray shape and dolphins. It's interesting you always refer to animals and similarities with nature, but...
it's amazing because flying saucers, whether they're discs, whether they're trianguloid, whether they come out looking more like Batman's Batarang, or whether they come out looking like some kind of an egg with crescent tines, still, when you really study the whole vehicle and when witnesses describe the engineering inside of the vehicles, the configuration of the various layout of, you know, the floor plan, you know, whatever they see that allows you to picture rooms and levels, they seem to mimic and model sea animals, specifically sea animals that are more often than not invertebrate sea animals, like either echinoderms, which includes not so much your starfish, though they are echinoderms, but for the discussions of flying saucers seem in many cases to resemble sand dollars and sea urchins, but without the spines.
That is interesting.
And their power conduits, however, the power conduits are laid out, seem to be in the same omnisymmetric or pentasymmetric manner that echinoderms' entire neurology is laid out. You see what I'm saying? It's not so much bilateral symmetry as it's more like pentagonal or completely circular symmetry, universal symmetry in some cases. Whereas your stingray vehicles are more laid out and with bilateral symmetry, which is... You know, the Roswell ship would be the number one example of stingray-type ship, but there were plenty of those observed also in the 90s. Especially off the coast of New York and New Jersey and also off the coast of California.
And do you think these are craft that were kind of the same model or very similar to the Roswell craft?
For a long time, I was in the general belief that vehicles, like many of the kinds of aircraft and ships and everything that we have here, set themselves into design character, design categories like what we would call classes. You know, kind of sort of like shuttle classes or starship classes or warship classes. What I found out and what I believe now, and mind you, this is my opinion, I could be wrong, I believe that it's not so much that they follow specific classes or design parameters. I believe that a lot of them are custom designed individually for flight crew that are at the same time being genetically engineered and artificially gestated to operate and otherwise man the spacecraft. I also believe that the spacecraft, regardless of configuration, are grown in, you know, extremely hot vats involving metal crystalline chemistries following what could best be described as chain molecules that provide the blueprinted information inside the actual liquefied hot materials that eventually coalesce to form each vehicle, which is metal-crystalline, and everything forms in layers, including the analogy of its neurology, which is, of course, what we would call the electronics and the electronic hardware that carries the programming and the operating systems for, onboard sophisticated vehicles.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting because...
I believe that...
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, go ahead. Go ahead with
I was
point.
Just going to say that, first, if people go look at your model, and you could go to Alien UFR Art Online and see what your drawings look like, and then you go look at the Craft of Skunk Works, I think, you know, that'll give people a teaser as to what's going to be in your book, which I'm really excited about for. But what's interesting about what you're saying now is it reminds me of DNA, because DNA is essentially the programming, the instructions on how to build an animal, a biological creature. So
precisely.
If someone was
That's
able
the whole
to
point.
Yeah, get that technology and then have this thing grow with instructions.
Precisely. Chain molecules carry the information. If they are a double helix, if they are a triple helix, if they are a quadruple helix, there might not be a limitation to how many helixes you have, depending on the complexity of each constituent molecule. But the basic concept is that the information carried within these spirals of replicated mathematics, with each metal crystalline compound that's within these helixes representing an instruction, then theoretically you could grow a spacecraft in a vat the way you grow an organism inside of an egg or a womb.
Mm-hmm.
But you would need extremely high temperatures and high pressures, which you would find. Basically, I would say alien shipyards are inside of the deep atmospheres of gas giants, which the deeper you go, the higher pressure they get. And as you get closer to the center, the hotter they get. The most prevailing theory right now is the gas giants in the deeper depths actually rain diamonds the way Florida rains, water from the clouds.
Really?
Because wherever you have carbon under extremely high heat and extremely high pressure, you get diamonds.
Mm-hmm. Reminds
me. So those same conditions would be how you create vehicles, how you design and manufacture vehicles in a sort of automated way, each with its own individual custom design.
Mm-hmm.
That is designed to match the kind of flight crew that you're breeding for it.
Hmm. Wow.
And that they, in combination with each other, formed a combined being with the organic components, which are the organic chemistry system users, and they provide a lot of the insight and perhaps the closest thing to a soul, while the machine system itself provides the habitation, it provides the transportation, it provides the life support requirements, it manufactures the environment that those organisms need in order to survive. It hydrates them if they need water. It provides absolute sterility so that they don't require an immune system inside their ship. There would also be nanotechnology involved because there are forms of cosmic radiation that'll penetrate almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so soft tissue, especially neurological tissue, would have to be constantly repaired. And if organic soft tissue is being repaired, especially neurological soft tissue, such as nerve cells or their dendrites or their axons, then and the connections in between them, where the chemical neurotransmitters and the electrical, the tiny electrical voltage voltages are transferred, which is how information is conveyed in neurological systems, they would need to be under constant repair. That would be handled by nanotechnological, you know, microsurgical bots that are smaller than the cells themselves that would actually be able to repair DNA or, you know, deoxyribonucleic acid or ribonucleic acids, or mitochondrial DNA, or anything that maintains the substance of the information and those cells' abilities to continue to reproduce accurately without me getting, you know, mutations or sports that are too random in order to sustain the organism.
Mm-hmm.
What you don't want when your cells are dividing is to create an analog to cancer cells, or an analog to cells that can no longer reproduce. Also, you have to deal with the chemistries that cap and otherwise bind DNA in order to keep strands from losing at each end. You see what I'm saying? Because otherwise DNA will break off with time.
Hmm.
So, you know, those caps also have to be maintained in microsurgical bots at the nanotechnological scale, you know, is how that could be accomplished with these higher and more advanced space-faring species and their technologies.
Mm-hmm. All technologies that are theorized and we're actually working towards, I mean, we're understanding DNA better and better. And of course, nanotechnology is a big area right now. And you read every day in medical journals about people moving towards these technologies, which is also really interesting.
Well, you can cut through 400 pages of a book and just get to the last sentence of the last chapter, which is quite simply this. Advanced organisms that are self-aware and able to design and manufacture technology from materials surrounding that organism in the environment, such as metals and crystals and liquid crystals and, you know, inorganic materials that can be combined properly so that you don't have to worry a whole lot about corrosion, chemical corrosion, and, you know, very substances that are chemically very inert, like water itself is a very inert substance that does not degrade over time if it's pure.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens in a situation like that is you end up with handheld tools, machine systems, internalized machine systems, and the exteriors of those machine systems that have longevity. You know, you could have machines that, unlike a car or a truck, is ready for the junkyard in 10 to 15 to 20 years. You end up with a machine that might last 20,000 years or even 200,000 years, possibly, mm-hmm. before time and entropy, which is all material in the universe, goes from a more orderly state to a less orderly state with the passage of time. And so entropic forces, you know, eventually consign it to a more degraded existence. And, you know, you can breed subsequent generations of flight crew to continue to operate these existing vehicles. And with each vehicle being designed to a specific flight crew, to its needs, to, you know, the ongoing mission and everything, it makes a lot of sense, and it also represents a profound wisdom in the spending or discharging of resources with a very reasonable rate of return.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is more easily illustrated with money and geopolitical economics on this world, but on other worlds, it's about, we have X number of resources, we have these sort of things that we want accomplished, we have these agendas, these are our needs in order to survive and maintain ourselves with enough diversification in order to maintain our various species. So here's how we're going to spend our resources.
Mm-hmm.
Resources is not just money. It's minerals. It's materials. It's both organic and inorganic. That which is mined. That which is grown. That which is harvested. That which is chemically converted into something else. That which is chemically combined with something else. That which is manufactured through the process of growing it in a microgravity environment. That which is maintained in a high gravity environment under high heat and pressure.
Mm-hmm. And these are
technology.
These are ideas that are this is what some of this forensic work on these spacecraft has drawn you to these conclusions?
These are the ultimate conclusions of, you know, basically nearly 30 years worth of observation and, you know, over 25 years of actual research on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
It's the eventual outcome. It's, you know, what does it all mean? Well, way beyond Star Trek and all of this other stuff, in the end, what you end up with is machine systems and organic system users, regardless of whether they are bipedal, humanoid, primatoids on, you know, a planet like Earth, or whether they are mollusks that are intelligent like octopus and squid being maintained in a wet environment, you know, a salty wet environment on another world. It's really irrelevant. Intelligent organic life must co-evolve with self-aware machine systems, with technologies that become more and more self-aware to the point where they become interdependent upon each other in order to maintain their needs at the optimal degree of performance. For organic life, obviously, you know, life support is required, sustenance, respiration, such as, you know, oxygen, hydration, if they depend on water, mm-hmm. instead of something more exotic like methane or helium. It really doesn't matter. Life needs to be sustained and it needs to reproduce. The manner is less relevant than the need itself. If the need is efficient and the manner is conducted in a way that does not exceed the availability of the resources, meaning as long as you don't outspend yourself and end up, you know, with a checkbook in the red, figuratively speaking.
Where we're headed.
Then you... Hello?
Where we're headed, I said.
Well, that's a political thing. I'm talking right now about, you know, far-flung future.
Right,
you know,
right.
I'm being a futurist here for a moment.
Right.
But...
Of course, but the point being that you have to get there.
Well, UFO research shows us a vision of things that could come. It shows us a vision of that which could possibly be one possible future,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, is not an unpleasant future to contemplate.
Yeah.
If other civilizations are already there, then that gives us an example that we can follow where we don't destroy our world in the process,
mm-hmm.
because we can expand to worlds that are unable to sustain life and you know, mine the crap out of them.
Do you think that could possibly be part of the reason they... are demonstrating their technology to us to show us that there is this option?
Well, without going too deep into territory I'm going with my book, there are substances that they absolutely need, and that's based on just surveying the research of all of the good UFO researchers all over the world over the last 30 years, starting with Len Stringfield. I had a relationship with him during the last week of his life. I got... boatload of information from him before he died. And, you know, beginning with him and ending with tons and tons of other people, including Mike Schrett, that attends a lot of the same events that you and I do, I ended up being able to, you know, pin together a few basic patterns and trends about what is it here that we have that they need. Well, there are some critical substances here, both organic and inorganic, that would bring alien species here. Starting with the inorganic, liquid water. Liquid and frozen water is a huge need for both machine systems and for organic life, sustaining organic life. You can't do it without water. You can't do it without hydrogen and oxygen, and it's done with water. And water is, you know, the easiest source for getting both hydrogen and oxygen and also for maintaining hydration in more complex chemistries involving that in order to sustain the organic system users.
But water isn't that rare, right? I mean, they find gaseous water.
But Earth has beryllium. It has magnesium. It has gold. It has manganese. It has a number of minerals and geological substances that have been leaked to be a part of that metal crystalline series of, shall we say, for lack of a better word, an alloyed substance that seems to make up various layers inside the spacecraft, regardless of their configuration. These things probably form the synthetic neurology that the vehicles mimic. It probably goes to not only the ability to conduct electricity, but also the ability to maintain and conduct plasma, or the ability to maintain and conduct in a controlled manner magnetic fields. These are all things that have to be maintained, that need to be conducted, that need to be channeled, and that need to be recycled in order for the vehicle to maintain its ability to continue to function, a self-sustaining machine system. So, boron is another substance that I've heard about. There's three isotopes of osmium that have been mentioned in the popular research. Various metals and substances on the periodic table that at the time they were mentioned were unknown that have now been identified and known, such as element 115 that Bob Lazar was talking about in 1980, in the early 80s, that he is, that has since been confirmed on the periodic table by, the appropriate chemists throughout the world. Element 116, I believe, is another substance that has been confirmed after being predicted accurately by Bob Lazar. I mean, you can go on and on and on with this, but when you are dealing with species that are between, say, 10,000 and 2 million years in advance of us, and there's probably at this point I would figure about 11 of them, some of them designated into subspecies, races, and castes. It looks to me like, that some of them are between 2 years evolutionally advanced on us to 10,000 years, and the technology seems to start at about 10,000 years in advance of what we've got right now, to maybe 50,000 years in advance of what we've got right now. Anything beyond that does not require a relationship between flesh and machine anymore. At that point, life can sustain itself without body and without machine systems. You know, which is why your type 2, type 3 civilizations that were described by Michio Kaku, Dr. Michio Kaku out of the University of New York.
Mm-hmm.
He's on TV a lot talking about these kind of things.
So getting back to the craft then and some of what you've said here, then you feel that the craft are self-aware and they have this sort of symbiotic relationship with our pilots.
They are, but they have limitations. Navigation is one of them.
Hmm.
You see, you can crunch. If you are out in space and you want to accurately go from one location in one part of a galaxy to another location in another part of the galaxy, you need basically 7 points. You need 3 sets of coordinates that make up your location where you're at, 3 sets of coordinates to make up the location where you want to go, and 1 set of coordinates that, for whatever reason, you need in order to maintain the correct angles and everything in interstellar navigation. That extra set of coordinates is probably galactic center. So you end up with a minimum of 21 numbers that have to be crunched by a very complex supercomputer, preferably something that's bordering on AI, preferably a computer system that uses distributed processing rather than having a single massive brain-like processor, in order to achieve what's called convergent solutions, which allow for predicted emergent behavior, or in this case, a course that would be required in order to jump to hyperspace, drop to subspace, fold space in real time without a time constant, or possibly enter into another realm that could be best described as quantum slipstream. But there's problems inherent with superluminal travel, which is different words that are very popular in the media for describing what I've just said. Calculations can sometimes fail. And when calculations fail, you end up with where you might arrive at the correct destination, but in the wrong time. And you might not even know what time you arrived in. Or you might arrive in the correct destination in the correct time, but in the wrong history, because you somehow accidentally dimensionally slid into a parallel universe and you ended up at a parallel destination from the perspective of history. Do you understand what I'm saying?
So travel using these technologies is much more troublesome and can cause many more headaches.
Absolutely. It's not as simple as, you know, having a start point, which is your home world or your home solar system, because the scale doesn't really affect anything. You could be anywhere within your home solar system, and you can locate all of the observable pulsars surrounding your solar system that are in other locations throughout the galaxy. Those are rapidly spinning neutron stars.
So, and I think you're getting to why the relationship needs to happen, why there needs to be a pilot.
There you go. And I'm glad you're seeing that. Because even if you have a bunch of pulsars so that you're able to get a general configuration of what part of the galaxy you're in, there's still the possibility of getting lost in space, lost in time, or lost in the wrong history, which is called sliding into the wrong dimension. So what you end up needing in order to navigate is you need organic brains that are linked directly, telepathically, or electrochemically to the inorganic operating systems of the vehicle. The operating system literally needs to be the outside case of the actual power core itself. And your remote viewing flight crew, they need to be able to visualize the target point by remote viewing the target point, and they all have to have consensus. So that means whatever combination of artificial intelligences and organic brains sitting in the heads of your organic system users, it has to be an odd number because there has to be a consensus. The consensus then gives the entire entity, both organic and inorganic, the confidence to make the jump, make the drop, make the fold, or, you know, enter the wormhole.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, although a consensus, I guess, could sometimes be wrong, huh?
A consensus could be wrong. And if it's wrong, somebody ends up someplace they don't want to be, and then they're on their own.
Uh-huh.
Kind of like pioneers that got lost in the mountains, you know, around the continental divide between Nebraska and California.
Uh-huh.
You know, if they get lost, they get lost.
Yep.
Whatever happens to them, happens to them. Most cultures won't worry about that because the evidence also suggests that regardless of species, the cultures don't go after their own. They don't rescue those that have crashed or those that are lost. They let them go the way you have a bunch of bees in a hive, and you got worker bees that disappear every day. Some are eaten. Some got old and died. Some met with some kind of mishap. Whatever happens to them, whether they're ants or bees or whatever, there ain't no search parties going to waste their resources looking for them. So that particular flying saucer of whatever kind of configuration it is and whatever its flight crew is, whatever combination of artificial intelligence and organic chemistry system user, they're just lost. They're lost. And they don't return.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I know you've looked into quite a bit is abduction. So, and you've talked about why they may want to come here for resources. What are your ideas about the motivations for abducting people?
Oh, well, you know, I'm sitting there talking about liquid water. I'm talking about frozen water. I'm talking about various minerals and crystalline chemistries that are required. But the most important thing is compatible DNA. You know, you remember Jurassic Park, in the movie Jurassic Park, Michael Crichton's books and mm-hmm. in Steven Spielberg's movies, they say, well, there were gaps in the DNA. We weren't able to extract 100% of the DNA, so we filled the gaps with frog DNA, and it worked just perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that?
Yep.
Well, we are the frog DNA. We are compatible enough that just about all of these species, with possible exceptions of reptilians, and primarily being, you know, what you call the gray aliens, those are all best described as having compatible deoxyribonucleic acid, to where they can take whatever combination of the four basic amino acids that make up our double helix in whatever combinations, and literally plug it in. Just plug it in like rebuilding a section of Legos that got kicked. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
For them, it's that easy. It's like our children with their Legos.
And do you have an idea as to why we are so similar to them? So for the example with the frog, it was an amphibian, which I guess they felt was close to the dinosaurs, which back then I don't think they knew or had the – it wasn't as strong of evidence as dinosaurs being related to the birds.
Well,
but
in the latest medical science shows that xenotransplantation is possible.
Mm-hmm.
Not apes to humans, but for instance, you can graft pig skin to humans for extreme burns, and it will take, as long as it's properly prepared with the right chemical solutions, living pig skin can be grafted to human burns until such time as the human skin cells have started to regenerate.
Mm-hmm.
And pig skin performs the same function of semi-permeable protection that normal human skin would have prior to the horrific burns that poor sap experienced. So, you know, it's the same general concept of xenotransplantation. It turns out that the DNA between us and sheep, us and pigs, is probably less than 7%. The DNA differences between us and chimpanzees, Pan troglodytes, is probably 4%. And the differences between us and Pan paniscus, the pygmy chimpanzee, is less than 2.3%. So, again, it wouldn't surprise me to find that the DNA on a lot of them is actually closer to us even than Pan paniscus. Mm-hmm. It might be 1.1%. It might be 1.2% difference. It might be shockingly identical to where if you got alien DNA and you ran it as basic gels in the various DNA tests, you'd end up with something that looks totally human to you.
So, and that's what they're harvesting is our DNA.
From us, directly. They're harvesting our DNA, and they're also, some of them, I don't want to say all of them, because a lot of them probably don't care, but some of them see something else in us that maybe they perceive is something that they once had and that they lost. A lot of the abductees say that they've lost their ability for a spirituality or a spiritual relationship between them and, you know, their creator in the universe. And who knows? There's no way to test for that. There's no way for a detective to hunt the information in order to build any kind of anthropological database on that kind of behavior or that kind of drive or psychology. But It's fun to speculate on, especially if you're writing science fiction, especially if you're writing, you know, something that is more in the New Age context rather than the nuts and bolts context that, you know, a lot of us, you know, UFO investigators have been doing for a long time. I run into people that get very aggravated with me because I am so hardcore in my nuts and bolts, and, you know, I don't like to speculate wildly. I have people that get in my face and insist that I speculate wildly, kind of like what I did today with you. But it's not something that I'm comfortable with until I have more facts, you know. If I got to live with them the way Jane and Goodall lived with the chimpanzees in Gombe, if, you know, those stories about the astronauts going to live on planet Serpo with all those aliens and then come back decades later was a true story, and if I was one of them, then I would be eminently qualified to make such comments. But I don't believe in the Serpo stories. I think that that's just part of the greater mythology of ufology, which is why I don't like the word, because ufology implies some research and a whole lot of mythology and some pseudo-religious context is applied, and I don't like that.
Mm-hmm.
I am a UFO researcher. I am a person who researches aerial phenomena, and I am a detective about it. I don't have materials to examine or to have third-party scientists examine them. So I apply detective methods and standards as opposed to scientific method because I don't have enough materials on hand to apply scientific method. I got nothing to test. All I have is anecdotal stories from very, very reliable are on death's door. And, you know, there's an old adage, but I found it to be completely true. People generally don't want to lie on their deathbed. When they're dying of cancer and the morphine isn't working anymore and they're gritting out agonizing pain and they are fully conscious, they achieve a clarity of memory. And that's when you want to get them to describe their spacecraft and describe their flight crew. When I investigate UFO cases, I don't go up to the guy, I want to know about your background, I want to know why you saw this, why were you there, you know. Everybody else has done that ad nauseum. There is a true test, especially when you have multiple witnesses, for determining whether a person's blowing smoke up your ass or whether the person is telling you the truth. And the truth, remember, is the truth as they perceive it. If they believe what they're telling you, they're telling the truth. They are not liars. Whether they are, in fact, describing something that actually happened is a separate issue.
Mm-hmm.
But if I tell you the sky is green and to the way my brain looks at the sky and it's green, then I'm not a liar. So it's a very simple test. If I have even a basic concept of what the thing was supposed to look like, and it doesn't even matter, I don't even need that basic concept, but I can start with witness number one and I can say, you know what, don't be intimidated by me at all. I simply want you to describe what you saw and who you saw with it. And I use innocuous words like who and what, because that doesn't salt their memories.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't, you know, put any ideas, well, maybe they were reptiles, well, maybe they were grays, well, maybe it was this. I get them to describe to me what they saw. I take notes. I get them to reiterate what they saw. I get them to tell me the story in the exact sequence that it happened. Then I get them to tell me the story again, this time what it would be like if they were an outside observer observing somebody like themselves and the event from a third-party angle. Then lastly, I get them to describe what happened from the last event back to the first event. If there are no significant deviations in the story, then I'm ready to move on to the next witness if I'm lucky to have one.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of the Roswell ship, I had 28 witnesses.
Wow.
All dead. All describing the same vehicle and the same flight crew. And the basic concept of what I wanted to, what I was looking for, came from Len Stringfield himself, from the three Army physicians that he had interviewed back in the early 60s,
mm-hmm.
but or the early 50s. He himself was a United States Army intelligence officer from the precursor to United States Army Security and Intelligence Command, INSCOM. So, you know, you get a lot of good information. You also want people with pedigrees. You want military intelligence people when you can get them. You want aviators of every kind. You know, anybody that's been to flight school because they're trained to observe. You want cops. You want firemen. They're all trained to observe. You want soldiers, Marines. They're all trained to observe. Just about every Navy technical specialty and every Air Force technical specialty, they're trained to observe. The airmen and officers involved in the Rendlesham case, you know, the Bentwaters Woodbridge Rendlesham Forest case, back in December 1980, was they were all trained observers, and some of their stories were different. But then we found out that you had different observers in different locations observing what appears to be different vehicles operating probably without organic flight crew, probably remote operating.
Hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were fairly small vehicles described.
Yeah. I don't think a neonate fetus-style alien or one of the little gray shorts would be large enough to become.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're starting to run out of time, so but before we're done, I do want to ask you, you know, having done all of this research and seeing maybe patterns, And given what you've described about the motivations, do you see then any change? It doesn't seem like, at least with this scenario, there'd be any reason for them to change what they're currently doing.
There's no reason for them to change what they're currently doing, with the exception of the ones who may be interested in us the way some of us are interested in apes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a very small subset of the human population worldwide who wants to specialize in simian behavior studies. Simians are your apes and your monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, every so often you get a Jane Van Lawick Goodall, who's now Dame Jane Goodall. She was knighted by the British government. You have people like Diane Fossey, who I knew personally back in 86, who was murdered. You have a number of people who specialize in primatology today. They're a very unique subset of the scientific community and a micro percentage of the human population in total. And I would say that there is the same micro percentage of population within those alien species who find us as interesting as some of us find apes.
Mm-hmm. And what change then with those, that group, might there be? Attempt at contact or attempt at forming a relationship, you think?
I think that there's been a little bit of contact throughout the whole thing. I'll crunch the numbers same as Richard Dolan has. I don't think that there's been more than 15,000 legitimate alien contact or crash retrievals. You know, if you combine all your alien contracts, your abductions, and your crash retrievals, whether you choose to dump in just the close encounter or the first kind basic sightings or not, I don't think there's been more than 15,000 legitimate cases worldwide going back to prior to 1930. Well, actually, I take that back. We can go back to 1897 with that, to the Aurora, Texas case, and what I suspect is the Fatima visitation as well.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly the Lourdes, France visitation, maybe even Guadalupe Island.
So a much smaller number than some researchers, many.
Right, but let's say that the UFO crash at Roswell, which is the most reliable case in history,
mm-hmm.
with the most, from a detective's perspective, the most verifiable information in history. If there's only one case, and you find the wreckage of an alien spaceship that's clearly not of this Earth, and a flight crew that clearly does not share the biology of any hominoid intelligence on this Earth, All it takes is one.
Mm-hmm.
All it takes is one. Once you have the evidence and can disclose it to the population, it only takes one case.
Yeah.
What if the Roswell case was the only true example of a UFO with a flight crew ever to contact the Earth? And what if ancient aliens and all that other stuff was just a pipe dream?
Mm-hmm.
You've still proven that UFOs exist and that aliens exist.
Right.
You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I think that I subscribe that there are 15,000 legitimate cases going back as far as 1897.
Mm-hmm. So before we end...
I think that there were...
mm-hmm.
I was going to say, I do believe that there was ancient contacts and landings, probably 4,000 or 5,000 worldwide between 10,000 BC and, say, 3,500 BC. Mm. I do believe the Puma Punko is evidence of ancient extraterrestrial construction. But I also do believe in antediluvian civilizations because I choose to believe in it.
But
it's fun to believe in it.
But given
there is evidence to support it.
The future. your thoughts on, because you were getting somewhere where you said, you know, there was that small group.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, and how things may change.
I don't see any reason for them to change their agendas or change the way in which they contact us.
Yeah.
We don't have the technology yet to compete with them in any way. There's also the possibility that they are a threat in many ways. And I believe that there is a global paramilitary opportunity, or operation ongoing to prevent some of them from over-harvesting. In other words, from taking more of us than they ought to be taking.
Mm-hmm.
I am a firm believer in that. I believe that some of them might even see us as a food source, the way we would ranch cattle or sheep or even cavies, you know, guinea pigs. They're delicious, you know, down in the South American countries like Chile and Argentina. Mm-hmm. They eat a lot of cavies. Cavies are guinea pigs. Up here, they're pets. Down there, they're food, like rabbits.
Right.
So, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if some of the reptilian, dinosauroid, probably some of them being descendants of what we call, the raptor-type dinosaurs, the dromaeosaurids. You know, if some of them are dromaeosaurid, then maybe they like the flavor of, earth primates, earth mammals.
Yeah. It sounds gross to me, but I'm a vegetarian, so.
Well, they might find us as delicious as my pet python found my neighbor kid's hamster.
Uh-oh. Well, I get you. So, interesting stuff. And people can go to Alien UFO Artwork or AlienUFOArt.com for more, including
Let me change that around a little bit. AlienUFOArt.com is where you go to get my wife's book,
right.
For the Haunted. Her book, Help for the Haunted, with all of her 16 years of ghost research, was published by Richard Dolan, and it's out. And if you go to alienufoart.com to the homepage and click on the book cover, it takes you straight to Amazon. The book's only $13.95 plus shipping and handling. It's a great book. Everybody from clergy to school teachers have given Laurie enormous compliments on it.
Mm-hmm.
I've got 4 books that are completed, 4 that are science fiction that are completed, and 1 that is being revised right now. That's my nonfiction book on Roswell. Richard Dolan will be publishing my Roswell book. He's already said so. And I have a contract with him. More importantly than any of that is if you need my artwork. Now, my artwork is something that I'm extremely proud of.
And it can be seen at this website also.
Yes, you can. You need to go to the Alien UFO art page. That's one of the pages in my wife's list on the homepage. If it says Alien UFO art, click on that, and then there's 2 or 3 pages with my stuff on it. The other thing you can do if you really want to see some good artwork really fast is to go to me on Facebook. Go to Facebook. Look for Bill McDonald, or you can just put it into your browser as facebook.com/WLM author, and my page pops right up, and it's got a couple of references to Laurie's Help for the Haunted on it, but it's got a lot of my original drawings. Some of them are UFO themed, some of them are science fiction themed. One of them is the Loch Ness Monster stalking a fisherman at the side of the lake.
Hmm.
Which I actually drew while I was sitting there at the side of the lake.
Oh, cool.
And it's some of the roses that I do. There's a lot of different things. I can draw just about anything. I do wildlife. I do marine life. I do aviation. I do portraits. I do your favorite pets and horses, whatever. Plus the UFOs. Plus the UFO experience. experiences. Plus, if you're an abductee and you're trying to figure out, you're trying to recall the spacecraft you saw, you're trying to recall the flight crew, the doctors, the alien beings that were handling you, just get a hold of me through Facebook or get a hold of me through alienufoart.com.
All right, cool. Yeah, lots of really cool stuff there. And we'll put up the link on the site when we post the show. So thank you so much. I know you've got a cough there, and you're a busy guy. But
I apologize. I just got over a super bad flu, and I've got bad bronchitis.
Yeah, well, hopefully you get over that really soon. But thank you so much for coming on the show.
It was a pleasure, and thank you for being my new friend in Arizona there.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you all so much for joining us once again, and I want to thank Bill McDonald. It's wonderful. He's been coming to the local Phoenix MUFON meetings, and so it's been great to get to know him, and especially because, to me, you know, when I made the tester model, it was because it was done with all of this research on what the Roswell craft looked like. So, of course, that was really, really exciting for me. So to meet him, I was really shocked. I was like, wow. And he came up and introduced himself to me, and I was like, I know who you are. So that was really cool. So it's fun to get to know him. He's a really neat guy. As you can hear, he's full of information. So really cool stuff. Thank you very much. And don't forget to go check him out at his website, alienufoart.com. That's ran by him and his wife. So really cool stuff. Otherwise, we are super busy with the UFO Congress. Like I said, there is just some really, really cool stuff going to be going on there. I mean, just this morning, I was looking at a post from Chris O'Brien about cattle mutilation. He'll be talking at the conference. Really, really good stuff there. I think we've talked about Jeremy Corbell. He's going to be like the next big thing in this field, I think. He's got these amazing films. He's put together some interviews with some never-before-seen research. In fact, I haven't even seen it, so it'll be new for me. So that's really exciting. Clifford Mahudi, we've talked about American Indians at the beginning of the show, and, of course, we're on a reservation, the conference, so we love to honor the contributions of American Indians. Clifford Mahudi will be starting out the conference talking about that. Joan Bird, a PhD, who has done some meticulous academic work around UFOs in Montana. The Allagash guys, oh my gosh, this is, we're going to hear, I'll tell you now, you're going to hear a lot about the Allagash case from me, because I don't know if anybody else picks it up. I don't care. I love this case. These guys are amazing. I've talked to them. I'm going to interview them a lot, and we are going to have a lot of material from Allagash coming up in the next few weeks, because this is one of the best cases. It needs to be covered more. It's as important and as incredible as the Travis Walton case. You people need to pay attention to this case. It's really good. We're also going to have Cheryl Costa. She's really cool. She writes, Jason, you know, puts together the news every morning, you know, headlines from around that are mainstream news out there that we put out every day. And she writes some of those stories. She writes for a Syracuse paper out there. She's going to be talking about 200 years of UFOs over New York. We're also going to have someone talking about the New York's Hudson Valley, Linda Zimmerman. In fact, there was a documentary made about her book on this that was in won an EBE award at our film festival. So we'll have that. James Gilliland, I don't know if people know he's going to be there because he was kind of a latecomer to confirm him. But he has a ranch in Washington where they see UFOs all the time. He has a very peaceful message to share with everyone. We're going to have a night watch with Ben Hansen. Yvonne Smith will be there to help us with some abduction panels and to do some experiencer stuff. You're going to hear never before heard incredible news stuff on the Rendlesham Forest from John Burroughs and his lawyer. And his lawyer isn't there to sue anybody at the conference. Don't worry about that. But don't cross him just in case, you know, because he will have his lawyer on hand. No, his lawyer's going to talk about how he's been trying to get their medical records. We're going to have Tom Reed, an incredible abduction case. James Clarkson talking about this incredible eyewitness whistleblower case. Oh, my gosh. We got Richard Dolan. We got Jaime Musan, George Knapp, Bob Lazar, and Mark Pilkington talking about Richard Doty, of course, as you know, one of my favorite topics. We'll also show his documentary which was mostly filmed at a UFO Congress many, many years ago. This conference is going to be incredible, people. Really cool. We've already filled up a couple hotels, but luckily there's a lot of nearby hotels that are just really around the corner. So still time to register and check it out. We hope to see you there. And as usual, you can get a hug from Jason McClellan and see what it's like to hug a reptilian alien. It's really nice, actually. They're supposedly cold-blooded animals, but they feel so warm and cuddly. Many of you have hugged Jason, and you've had that experience and enjoyed it, I'm sure. So all of this you can see at UFOCongress.com or OpenMinds.tv. Of course, we're still doing Spacing Out. We're doing it every other week. So we had one a couple weeks ago. We'll have another one coming up here on Friday just because we're so busy with the conference. But we've got a lot of great stuff, stories and everything at OpenMinds.tv. Come and check it all out. Thank you, by the way, to George Knapp for having me on Coast to Coast, and he's had a lot of other people from the Congress on to talk about the Congress, and he'll be there to speak. So thank you to Coast to Coast. You guys are awesome. And of course, thank you to Caleb Hanks, who does the opening and close music. You can find a link to his Chronicles, which is where he does his music, and he provides it for free. It's really cool stuff. I like to jam out to it myself. And thank you to you all for listening. You guys are so cool. We can't wait to meet some of you at the conference. Otherwise, go to our Facebook and to our Twitter to tell us hello, what's up, what you're thinking. And some of you guys that have some positive things to say, you're out there, which is great. But, of course, the complainers are out there in abundance as well. So we love to hear more and more from the positive people. Who doesn't? So please come out and say some nice things. And say, you know, hey, even if Jason is a reptilian or marine, that doesn't mean they're bad people. You can come out and help defend them on our YouTube page. So we will talk to you all next week. Adios, muchachos. Down the glass.